This is ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
In 2016, the death of 14-year-old Elijah Doherty sparked an emotional debate about the tension between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians in the West Australian mining town of Kalgoorlie.
Justice! Not enough justice!
As a black fella in this community, that it hurts. Hurts all of us. Now, black, white or otherwise, it was a child that was involved here. There was no justice here.
No justice, no peace.
That was almost 2 years ago, and today we're going to hear from a research team that looked into how young Aboriginal people in Kalgoorlie feel about race, identity and belonging. And we're also going to look to other parts of Australia that are facing similar tensions. I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by co-host Molly Hunt, who's sitting in a studio in Broome, especially for this broadcast. Molly, tell me a bit about yourself.
Hi, g'day. My name is Molly Hunt. I am the breakfast presenter in Broome for the Kimberley. I am a Ballingarra woman, and I'm also a Yolngu from my father's side.
And sitting beside Molly in Broome is ABC reporter Sam Tomlin. Now, Sam, you were a reporter based in Kalgoorlie in 2016. Can you take us back to the 29th of August 2016?
Sinead, you'd seen a situation develop in Kalgoorlie-Boulder where ongoing issues with crime, particularly juvenile crime, had seen a bit of a, I guess for lack of a better word, a toxic discussion, a toxic culture develop. And that obviously culminated in the events of August 29th, 2016, where, as you say, 14-year-old Elijah Doughty was run down and killed by a 56-year-old man whose identity remains protected by court order. That man was arrested and was due to make his first appearance in the Kalgoorlie Magistrates Court the next day, where a protest outside the court descended into a riot on Hannon Street, when a number of Doughty family members and supporters were unable to gain entry to the courtroom. Fast forward to July 2017, the man went to trial in the WA Supreme Court. He'd been charged with manslaughter, something that upset quite a few people. Proceedings, the trial didn't take place in Kalgoorlie, but proceedings were beamed live into the courthouse over the 5 days. And over the course of that trial, the man's lawyers argued that he had no intention to kill Elijah and was merely trying to retrieve his bike, which had been previously stolen. Prosecutors argued the man's reckless decision-making contributed directly to Elijah's death. But after 5 days, the 56-year-old was not convicted of manslaughter, but the lesser charge of dangerous driving causing death. That sparked an immediate wave of peaceful protests, both in Kalgoorlie and Perth and around the country. And the lesser charge also meant that the man was eligible for parole quite quickly. He was released earlier this year, a move that sparked further protests and I guess a fair bit of hurt for the Doughty family as well. So I guess while this has all been going on, there's been a lot of soul searching in Kalgoorlie, a lot of positives, you know, investment in public art through the Heartwalk program, bringing all sides of the community into revitalising the city centre, but also some pretty tough questions about how the community as a whole deals with kids on the margins of society and whether there's enough support available for the whole community.
What was it like for you, Sam, reporting in that environment and living in Kalgoorlie as someone who felt very passionately about the community?
It's hard to say because it's, you know, it's hard somewhere you called home for so long to comment with, I guess, dispassionate and a dispassionate objective nature. But like it just felt like when the riot broke out that this was kind of, it was almost due for a moment like this. Like these issues have been bubbling away below the surface and it was almost bound to happen in a way. And that was something that was reflected in a lot of the discussion around the community at the time.
Sam, thanks very much for joining us in Australia Wide. We're having a conversation today about the situation that arose in Kalgoorlie in 2016 and what's happened since. And at this point, I want to bring in Dr. Cheryl Kickett-Tucker. She's the editor and research lead of the Guthoo Report, a report commissioned by the federal government to delve into what were the drivers behind the social tensions in the town. And this report, it's specifically focused on the young Aboriginal people in Kalgoorlie-Boulder because, as Sam was describing, there was a high rate of antisocial behaviour in the town and young people had completely disengaged with what was going on. This report, Cheryl, is, I should say, Dr. Kickett-Tucker, sorry. You're obviously not big on that. There was some very alarming things in this report, but for you, what was the thing that concerned you most?
First of all, I think It was a courageous step by the federal government to actually go into the community and ask the children about their experiences, perceptions of living in Kalgoorlie-Boulder, which was the aim of the project. So that's the first thing. But I guess for me, the alarming finding was a third of the children we tested with a distress scale who had high psychological distress scores. So that tells me that a third of the kids that we engage, and we engage 71% of the population between the ages of 11 and 17, were traumatised and vulnerable children who had, you know, mental, social, physical issues, you know, to participate in that wider community. So they weren't from a level, you know, playing field. They had certain characteristics that I guess services should have taken more notice of.
These kids are between the age of 11 to 17 years old. I guess, can you tell us a bit about what other elements sparked these feelings?
The actual project that we were undertaking, I guess I should talk to you about the process, because the process is quite unique. So it was a three-stage project where, in the first stage, because we knew the kids were quite vulnerable, but we needed the data because government needs numbers, you know. So we did some work on the vulnerable kids in terms of doing an art therapy session to extrapolate some of the common themes about what life was like in Kalgoorlie, with the aim of developing an instrument to capture the data that the government wanted us to capture. So the kids helped co-design an instrument called Gutul. Gutul is a Wangatha word meaning we are one. That name came from the kids themselves. And in stage 2A, we piloted the instrument. And then in stage 2B, we did a full-scale study. And stage 3 was the dissemination of the results at the culminating in the Youth Summit that was held on the 6th of October last year. So some of the key questions in the survey itself was looking at their perceptions and experiences of living in Kalgoorlie, also looking at the access and protective factors to service access, and also what would a service in Kalgoorlie actually be like and needs to be like in terms of in the eyes of the children themselves, considering a lot of the kids were just, you know, not partaking in some of the services up there that was, you know, deemed for them.
And services like that would have been such as Headspace. That was one that wasn't being used at all. Why was that? Because you're saying it came down to psychological distress is one of the biggest issues that this report found. Why did young Indigenous kids not want to walk into Headspace and use it as a service?
Well, we did look at a couple of the criteria that makes a service important for Aboriginal kids to actually, you know, access that. And some of the findings were that whether or not the service was demonstrated and provided respect for that young person walking in the door without being negatively stereotyped, which is what happens in Kalgoorlie. All the kids in Kalgoorlie were stereotyped as being bad and negative, and there was something completely wrong with them. But our research showed that's not true. You know, there is a cohort of kids that, you know, get up to mischief and do the wrong thing, but they're not all the same. Like our project, we actually identified kids with enormous talent and enormous resilience and forgiveness, you know, despite how they were treated. But unfortunately, we tend to look at the deficits rather than the strengths of a community. And the one thing I wanted to ensure that this report and the government look at other strengths and the positive nature of the characteristics that the kids hold. But let's go back to the services. So some of the things in the services were things like the service and the actual people behind the service provided and demonstrated respect for that young person as a human being walking in that door needing assistance. They also the kids highlighted that there was a demonstrated and genuine care that people actually care about them as human beings, whether Aboriginal or a kid or not, didn't matter. They were a human being. Whether or not the service and the person behind the service had a pleasant nature, was friendly, whether they had patience and whether they were attentive to that person's, to the young person's issues, and also were they reliable. If that service said they were going to do something, did they have the integrity and do what they say?
You're listening to Australia Wide and you're with me, Sinead Mangan, and also Molly Hunt, who joins us from the Broome office of the ABC. I'll leave it to you now, Molly.
Dr. Hikitaka, you mentioned in the report, and you mentioned multiple times, the kids express psychological pressure. It also shows in the report the older kids tend to struggle a bit more. I guess, how does this affect them in the long run?
Oh, it's, Molly, that's a brilliant question, because what we found, the racism and discrimination affect every domain of Aboriginal wellbeing across the ages. So you would have a kid who was 7 or 8 who pretty much every day something would happen to them, and they didn't have the racial coping strategies in order to deal with it. So their way of dealing with race and racism and discrimination and was either be aggressive or completely just walk away from the situation. There wasn't a range of strategies to help deal with that situation. And as kids got older, they got more angrier, and they're frustrated because their strategies for dealing with that kind of interaction with the community members wasn't, they didn't have it. And then if you speak to their parents, the parents are in the same boat. So they only had two options. It's a kind of like a flight or fight response, which is not good psychologically, because in life, whether you're Aboriginal or not, a child needs a range of strategies in order to deal with matters that come into their life. And this is one of the areas we've found in research that kids with low self-esteem regarding their Aboriginality, their Aboriginal identity, have limited racial coping strategies. And then it plays out in school, where they won't go to school, they're not attentive at school, they close off from their friends, they just stick to their family members, they... you know, get caught up in the wrong cycle and the wrong, you know, behaviours. They do know right from wrong, but it's easy to go the other way, you know, and play out what the rest of society has pigeonholed them to be, which is naughty, bad, terrible kids. But when I went up there and I, you know, I met all these kids, I was blown away by the talent and by their generosity and their love and letting us to come into their life.
And this report, you were asked to look specifically at young people between 11 and 17. But
correct.
Of course, the rest of the community is not in this report. Mm. And there was, I mean, behaviour in the general community that was shocking. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. So should there be a light shone on that too?
There absolutely should be a light shone on that. You can't. Like, if you look at research as a sugar bowl and it's just one cube in the sugar bowl, you need other cubes to get the sugar bowl full to get the bigger picture. So you do need to find out the other side of the coin. What's the situation with the rest of the community? And is it the perceptions that the kids have told us, is it the perceptions of the rest of the community? You can't do research half-baked, because you're going to get a half-baked response. And the other thing I want to drive home is we really went into this looking at the strengths of these kids and giving the kids an opportunity to be trained up in event management, because at the end of stage three, when we did the youth summit, all the kids were employed on this project. There was 31 of them in the end, and they were trained in event management to run a youth summit and get on stage and perform. And a lot of them did documentaries about life. One young boy who was our MC wrote a book, and the book's being published by Fremantle Press. These are brilliant outcomes, you know. But they were given an opportunity to shine in their space without being pigeonholed negatively from the start. That's the difference. The way that we went around this project is the way I think the services and the government need to work with our community, rather than looking at the negatives, because you're going to come out with deficit modelling. We want to look at the strengths.
Dr. Higataka, now what needs to be done in Kalgoorlie?
I think there definitely has to be some action. And I agree with the federal government that all levels of government must come to the party when it comes to solving and, you know, moving in the right direction to solving some of the issues there. So we definitely need the local government authority involved. We need the state government involved, and we definitely need the federal government involved, which I know are behind this. A couple of the resolutions that we came out with, based on what the kids have said, one of the big issues was the kids do want to have a job, and the kids that we employed never had a job ever in their life in Kalgoorlie. And they know there's a lot of issues there, and we're not going to solve all the issues, but what we can do is set up and create an employment and training pathway by setting up this World Indigenous Youth Gathering to be held every 2 years, kind of like on the same basis as the Garma Festival. But the Aboriginal kids can actually plan, develop and run this this youth gathering from all youth around the world, because unfortunately in Australia, unless we shine the light of our challenges and our issues in an international stage, then the Australian public will start to look. So we've got to use, unfortunately, that kind of method madness to put a spotlight on us here. But some of the things that would come out of this would be training and employment in the tourism industry, career development, in leadership training, job interview, business etiquette, hospitality, retail, restaurant. The kids would be trained in this space to be employed across Kalgoorlie in these areas, but come together to run this World Indigenous Youth Gathering. But to make that happen, we need to set up a body called the GYM, and it's called the Good Little Youth Movement. And under that, the kids would actually run this youth movement alongside some dedicated kinship champions who will be identified in the community across all agencies to come together to help the kids move it forward.
Now, we have had a response to the Guthrie report from government. A spokesman for the Minister for Indigenous Affairs, Nigel Scullion, said the government will work with community groups like the Goldfields District Leadership Group and the existing Kalgoorlie Aboriginal Community Residence Group. The spokesman also said the department would determine how to provide regular engagement with families in Kalgoorlie-Boulder through these existing groups.
One of the questions was, Dean, do you remember when Grandad tipped the backhoe over out at the ball?
ABC Australia Wide.
And it was like, I thought, okie doke, that thing works.
On ABC Radio.
Dr. Cheryl Kickett-Tucker, thanks very much for coming into the studio and chatting to us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
All around the country, you're on ABC Australia Wide.
I eat corn sometimes and my mum cooks it in the oven.
Well, Charles, how much rain did we have? He said, no, none. I said, you're mad, man.
ABC Australia Wide.
Because I came from Wynyard area where it rains and rains and rains. And when it's raining more.
On ABC Radio.
One of the issues raised in the Guthrie report was that young Aboriginal people in Kalgoorlie had little or no faith in the police. In many parts of Australia, the police are working to try and improve that relationship. And Verity Gorman went out and had a look at one of those programs.
Got my hands in the right position. Here we go!
Thanks, Amelia.
There, now you have to find some fish.
This is Waylon, and he has a passion for fishing.
If it shrinks, it means you got a fish. Sometimes you need to roll up a little bit.
Have you caught anything yet?
Nah, but I will cook it. When I get the fish, I will cook it.
What are you hoping to catch?
Yeah, probably a big one. Hope I get a big one, not a little one.
Waylon is one of dozens of kids taking part in a holiday fishing program. It's run by the PCYC and local police.
I love the police because if you be bad, they'll keep you in jail. But my brother's in jail.
Is he?
He break in. When he gets out, we can see him. But only mum can see him, but we can't.
You don't want to be like that?
Nah.
So is that why you've come along to fishing?
Yeah, I'll be a fisher.
How many other brothers and sisters do you have?
We got 4 sisters, 4 brothers.
Wow, big family. So is it nice to come out and just spend a bit of time? Because yep. Is it quite busy at home?
Uh-huh. If you go stay at home, I'll be bored. I will be coming here.
Police say boredom is one of the major problems for at-risk youth. Senior Constable Troy Fisher is part of the Riverina Police District Youth Command.
Kids get bored during the school holidays. How about we do something for them? If they're with us, they're not committing any crime or getting into any trouble.
Well, how do they react to you being a police officer?
Look, they see us different to a police officer because we're not the sort of police officer that will arrest them. We fall under the youth command, so we're mainly focused on youth. So they do look at us. Once you build that rapport with them, they look at us differently.
Belcy is another young person taking part in the program. She says it's nice to get out of the house and get to know the police.
One of them taught me how to rod in the fishing rod and told me how to take it back out.
It's pretty fun when you hear the cops with the policemen because they keep you safe and that, just in case nothing happens.
Is it nice to sort of have a chat to them?
Yeah, but not Fisher. I like Paul. Paul's my favourite.
My name is Paul Mumbler. I'm the Aboriginal Community Liaison Officer with Wagga Police. We've been approached by FACS Housing to, I guess, try and occupy some of the kids. And these kids are what they call their housing tenant youth. Look, some of these kids probably wouldn't even get out of the house. And again, for some families, it means that they're going to get away from the telly, a PlayStation, and get out and actually do some physical stuff. we don't come into this to think that we're going to fix everything. That's probably one of the one thing that we have to try and maintain is we're not here to fix everybody. We're here to help as many as we can. If we're able to reach one or two out of ten, so be it. That's what we try and. Yeah, we try and build on as many as we can. That's the plan.
As Paul Mumbler just told Verity Gorman, little things can make a difference to one person. Over in Mount Isa in Queensland, the police have started a much more hardline programme to tackle antisocial behaviour and petty crime. It's called the Stop and Question programme and involves police questioning kids who are wandering the streets, photographing them and then driving them home. Inspector Chris Hodgman is in charge of the project and he joins us from Mount Isa.
Good afternoon.
Molly Hunt with you. Inspector Hodgman, this program has been up and running for a number of months now, and I'm curious, how do police target these kids? What are some of the things do you look for?
Yeah, look, we recognise the intrinsic link between children under 12 years of age being out on the street late at night and the harm associated with that. So we're trying to get these kids back home to their premises if we deem it safe. So unfortunately, if kids are out on the street at night, we also recognise the fact that they're not at school the next day. And as we know, again, if children aren't engaged with the school program or education here in Mount Isa, they're going to find it very difficult to find meaningful employment later in their life. So it's an interesting cycle that we're trying to break.
The program has its critics, though. 5 months into it, is there any evidence that it's making a difference to these kids?
Yeah, look, I think 5 months for this long-term problem isn't enough time to do a proper evaluation of whether we're having any effect. So what we've done is we've asked academia to come on board with us to make sure that what we're doing is the right thing long-term for these children. So I await that evaluation from an associate professor in criminology so that it can properly inform our business.
Inspector Hodgman, police are required to take photos in this program at kids on the street. If a kid is reluctant and doesn't want their photo taken, what is done?
Yeah, look, we're taking the photos by the consent of the children, and it has to be informed consent in regards to these youth that are out on the street. You know, some of these kids are 15 and 16 years of age as well, that are out at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. No good can come of that. So obviously we're not going to force children to take their photographs if they don't consent to that.
Being Indigenous myself, I know a lot of other Indigenous people who are reluctant to go to the police to seek help and have that trust. In the Guthu report, it said 46% of the kids said they would not go to the police to get help. In your personal experience, why do you think that is?
Yeah, look, there is a great deal of mistrust, unfortunately. And again, it's another factor that we need to try and break and bring kids back into our fold, because we have 8 Aboriginal police liaison officers here at Mount Isa that we rely heavily on to try and connect with the kids. We're also running some mentoring programs with the children, as well as our school-based police officers. So it's an ongoing program for us to try and increase the trust that these children have in police. I'm not sure the figures would be the same for Mount Isa. We do have a good relationship, and some of our programs that we're running are showing some great support. And I'm sure that some of the programs are connecting with some of these kids.
Inspector Chris Hodgman, thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
Thank you.
ABC Radio is your home of news and current affairs throughout the day, every day. Start your morning with AM at 8 o'clock, Monday to Friday, with Sabra Lane, and on Saturdays with Elizabeth Jackson. At midday, Eleanor Hall brings you The World Today. And at 6:30 each weekday evening, join me, Linda Mottram, for PM, a half an hour of the national news and analysis that you need to know. That's 6:30, Monday to Friday. ABC Radio, your home for news and current affairs throughout the day.
And thank you very much, Molly Hunt, for joining me for this very special edition of Australia Wide.
Thank you.
And if nothing else, this report speaks to a much wider problem, as we heard the inspector say, in Australia. And the main thing is to keep the conversation going.